Hi, everyone, and welcome to Climate Proofers, the show all about those on the front lines of adaptation, finance, tech, and policy. I'm Louis Woodall, the editor of Climate Proof, which you can read at www.climateproof.news. Now, my guests and I spend a lot of time on this pod discussing how we think climate risk and adaptation will reshape markets and challenge households and governments. Today, for a change of pace, we're discussing what you think by sharing the results of a survey that Climate Proof ran in partnership with FEA Finance Labs and the Inevitable Policy Response. We asked 12 big questions on how markets and governments are likely to respond to physical risks over the next 10 years, covering everything from what the probable impact on property insurance could be to what form the major macroeconomic spillover effects could take. The answers from over 80 participants reveal an emerging consensus on some facets of climate physical risk and wide divergence on others. For example, a plurality of respondents believe extreme weather events are likely to dominate the physical risk landscape over the next decade, a finding in line with climate science. But on the flip side, they are split on how they expect companies to respond to physical risks in their supply chains, and have varying views on the pace and scale of a climate risk-driven repricing of financial assets. To discuss the results, I'm joined on the pod by Jacob Thoma, the founder and CEO of FEA Finance Labs, a think tank that nurtures research solutions for the financial sector that address the climate crisis. He's also director of the Inevitable Policy Response, an organization that forecasts the speed and scale of the transition to net zero by assessing climate policies and surveying climate transition experts. I hope, and I think Jacob hopes too, that this poll will be the first of many we conduct together to create a long-running series showing how views on climate physical risk impacts evolve and grow over time. Note that the full results will be published by FEA Finance Labs and distributed by Climate Proof in the coming weeks, so keep an eye on those inboxes. Before we get to my conversation with Jacob, two quick housekeeping notes. First, a reminder that Climate Proofers is going off its regular schedule for a few months as I head into paternity leave. I have a couple of episodes in the hopper for release during my time away to keep you occupied, but the weekly schedule will not resume until later this summer. A big thank you, by the way, to all of you who reached out to share your best wishes for our new arrival. I really appreciated your messages. And second, as always, a reminder that Climate Proof is a reader and listener-supported publication. We need more paying members to put the publication on a sustainable footing and to help us grow. If you're finding our interviews, articles, and research valuable, please do consider upgrading by heading to www.climateproof.news/upgrade today. All right, in a moment, my conversation with Jacob, but first, a roundup of last week's top adaptation and resilience stories. In finance, private investors are shying away from urban adaptation projects because they too often lack clear revenue streams and attractive returns, according to a new report from the nonprofit C40 Cities. Cities in emerging and developing economies need $147 billion annually through 2030 for climate adaptation and $165 billion annually through 2050, but current investment flows cover only a fraction of that. The gap persists not because would-be investors are reluctant to invest in adaptation, but because too few projects meet the threshold for private investment. The nonprofit's analysis of adaptation projects where the private sector has played a role found that these typically have clear revenue logic and include revenue-generating assets, or are supported by strong public balance sheets. These are few and far between, however. C40 also found that many adaptation projects are too small on their own to interest heavyweight investors, and recommends that cities aggregate projects into larger portfolios and pool adaptation with mitigation assets to make them more attractive. In policy, the US Interior Department revealed emergency plans for the Colorado River system on Friday in response to a potential water and energy crisis caused by the region's extreme drought conditions. The department is ordering steep cuts to reservoir releases from Lake Powell, one of the system's two main reservoirs, while diverting water from a separate upstream reservoir to prevent important power infrastructure from failing. Together, the measures are projected to raise Powell's water level by 54 feet, buying the system another year of operational stability. At stake is the water and power supply for more than 40 million people across seven western states. Record low snowpack and a hot, dry winter have pushed the system to a breaking point. And without intervention, Lake Powell could fall below the elevation at which Glen Canyon Dam can generate hydropower as early as July. And in tech, Canadian early-stage technology investor NorthX Climate Tech is deploying $2.2 million across three wildfire technology companies in British Columbia. The follow-on capital investments target Crown AI, Nova, and Skywood Wildfire Technologies, each of which addresses a different aspect of wildfire risk. Crown will use the capital to deploy up to 500 monitoring devices across transmission corridors in British Columbia as part of its first full field operation. Nova will expand its aerial mapping platform, advancing from the use of drones to a true multi-platform system, spanning helicopters, satellites, and ground sensors. Meanwhile, Skyward is pioneering a technology that reduces lightning-caused ignitions, Canada's most destructive wildfire driver. Right, that's it for this week's roundup. Now onto my conversation with Jacob. Hi, Jacob. Where are you calling from today, and what do you do?
Hi, Louis. I'm calling from Berlin. I'm the CEO and co-founder of Thea Finance Labs, the director of the Inevitable Policy Response Program, and professor in practice at SOAS.
Jacob, you've been a mover and shaker in climate finance world since way before I got into this world, and I'm grateful for all your research and data and insights you provided on myriad platforms over the time. You really helped to educate me and I'm sure many, many others in this space. You're on the pod today because we co-hosted this interesting survey on climate physical risks and what market and government reactions to it could be. Before we get to that survey, can I ask a little bit about what Thea Finance Labs is all about, how it came to be, and what your goals are?
So Thea Finance Labs is a nonprofit think tank with a focus on finance, climate, and long-term risk in particular, and obviously also the impact perspective of climate change. Our premise is that we try and design research solutions in the nonprofit space. So we do the old school research reports and knowledge development, but also the tools that we hope can convert our research into implementation. And then we look at how to scale our research adoption. So we try and build be part of the value chain. We've done that over many years across many different topics. We incubated PACTA, which was the first methodology to measure the alignment of financial portfolios with climate goals back in 2015, pre-Paris Agreement. We've developed a My Fair Money, which we spun off to the Sustainable Finance Observatory as a retail investor platform. We've developed data solutions for SMEs on transition physical risk data that we spun off to Tilt. So we basically try and develop these research solutions, and then once they get too big for our shoes, try and find a long-term home for them. Because we know, as you do as well, it's very nice to have all these ideas, but when they just stay on paper, they sometimes can be quite limited in their adoption. Sure. And what's more is when they just permanently operate in either commercial or non-commercial solutions, they might not have the perfect home for them and maybe keep you a little bit less creative. And so we try and stay creative by never getting too big.
Yes, I like this idea of you incubating good ideas and then sending them out when they've learned to walk so that they can progress with other organizations. Besides Thea, though, you also have this role at the Inevitable Policy Response. And I was wondering if you could explain to our listeners a little bit about what that's all about.
Sure. So the Inevitable Policy Response was originally commissioned by the Principles for Responsible Investment, I think back in 2019. And the core premise is that we have myriad of climate transition scenarios. And those are all good and well, but they're not conviction-based. So they're just simulations of different futures, 1.5 degrees, no policy, current policy continuing, policy backsliding, right? You pick your optimization, there's a scenario for you, but they're not, like I said, they're not conviction-based. So just hypotheticals. And in fact, the modelers building them don't believe their own scenarios will happen, but by design, they're not supposed to, right? They're just there to simulate what the future would look like if it looked a certain way. And so Inevitable Policy Response, or IPR, his premise is to figure out, well, what do we think is actually going to ultimately happen now that we are on this transition pathway in some form? What do we think that will actually look like? So we develop a forecast, and we develop this forecast on the basis of a global survey of climate transition experts. We surveyed, just in our latest release in 2026, over 350. And we ask them, well, what do you think that will happen? And then we aggregate all those perspectives up to develop this kind of macro transition forecast. And of course, the tooling that supports that in order to allow financial institutions to develop their in-house forecasts. Because ultimately, I think one of the key things that we're trying to achieve with this public forecast is challenge financial institutions to build scenarios with conviction to identify what they think the base case of the transition will look like in relation to stress tests, to climate strategies, to target setting, and everything in between.
So let's get to the survey itself. We conducted a survey over the last month and a bit. I sent it out to my readers on Climate Proof. You sent it out to your list at Thea. Can you break down why you wanted to do this survey and some of the top level findings before we get into the nitty gritty?
I think what really ultimately motivated the survey is that one of the things that we do at Inevitable Policy Response is we canvass opinion about the state of the transition. So we did a project last year with an insurance company where we kind of approached this topic from that vantage point. We said, well, you know, we'll look at the transition risk and we've got this expert survey I mentioned. And then all we'll do is we'll survey your team internally to see what you think internally. So to your point earlier, Louis, we would get to the situation where you could form your own house view and actually take a view on that. And then we got to the physical risk side, and then we realized, all right, then we can pull in the, you know, the hazard maps, pick your poison. But like I said before, I think it was very clear from the conversations that we needed that sort of social understanding and that political understanding and that context and the understanding of the compound dynamics. So we did a mini version of this with this insurance company. And I just thought, wow, we really don't even know what we think, right? It's so weird sometimes when especially you work on these topics for a decade and then, you know, to use some traditional financial parlance, you don't even know whether you're a bear or a bull. Take the question of whether climate tipping points should be integrated or not. Is that something that seems like a crazy idea and would kind of, you know, make people think your exercise is off kilter? Or do actually most people think we need to consider those tipping points in the exercise? Like, we don't even know what other people think. Again, we also don't know how to sort of formulate which social dynamics do we need to prioritize. How do we, what do different people think, how they will manifest themselves? What kind of impacts we expect to see on that front? And so that's what motivated running this survey. It's not, you know, a panel exercise with all the bells and whistles of a full academic exercise. But look, it's just actually trying to level set where we are in discourse on these compound risks. Should we look at them? If yes, how? How do we expect just a handful of these examples to manifest? And so, you know, you and I worked obviously on designing the survey. We have some great help from some friends in the industry who looked at drafts of them and gave us some tips about the kind of questions they're interested in, and came up with basically more or less 10 questions. With the real core question that we're trying to ask is, how do you think governments, markets, and households will respond in the face of this class of physical risk that we expect to see both increase and that we're already seeing now materialize in different markets? So we're not asking which hurricane will make where landfall where. We're just asking, how do you think folks will respond to that reality? And hopefully you've got some interesting answers.
So we had 85 responses, a good mix of folks from financial institutions, research and advocacy, a few government folks, and then a lot of people under the other categories. I'm imagining these are practitioners, maybe at corporations, at consultancies, etc.
And folks can stay anonymous, Louis, I should add as well.
Yes. One of the reasons we got people to respond in the first place is that we said we wouldn't be putting their names to anything because some people are a bit nervous putting out their real opinions in the world, especially on climate-related matters. So we have a number of questions about how do we expect governments to respond to physical risk? Who do we expect to bear the cost of climate change? And I've got to be honest, one of my high-level takeaways was that there's a sort of despairing or pessimistic view, I feel. For example, on the question, how do you expect governments to respond to rising physical climate risk? We have 54% of people saying they think it's going to be mostly limited reactive disaster relief rather than actual proactive adaptation investment or systematic fight or flight strategies. And then on the question about who do you expect to bear the cost of climate change, a majority said households and property owners, and a smaller percentage said companies and financial institutions would actually bear the risk. And I also feel like some of the other responses kind of speak to a slow, reactive attitude towards climate physical risk, which actually might store up more trouble for the future. So that was my overall impression. I'd be interested in your overall impressions of those questions there.
So we really wanted to make the survey about what we expect to see happen over the next 5 to 10 years in the short-term time horizon. It would have been interesting, but beyond what was feasible, to see whether that new kind of changes as we go along. So whether we expect to see some kind of tipping point of its own, if you will, in the nature of response after 2035. Mm-hmm. I think you're right. I think there is sort of some of the high level takeaways, definitely the key one you already mentioned, which is households are going to be really left on their own to a large degree here. So the idea that governments are really going to do systematic support of households beyond disaster relief, especially in the context of stretched fiscal burden, that doesn't seem like people are super optimistic about that. Most people think it will be more limited and reactive rather than proactive. And that's a major flag, I think, for financial institutions trying to identify those risks, because that means we actually are expecting almost like in this, again, not to belabor the metaphors too much, but almost like in the transition risk side, the stranded assets are being continued to be built up. So as long as we just have reactive disaster relief and limited repricing, we're going to continue to see behavior that's going to ultimately increase the cost of climate change down the line because we're not adapting properly to them as climate change builds up. So the kind of behavior would need to adjust where people build, how people build, and how to socialize the cost and you know, make those societal adjustments. The clear message I would say from the survey is that most people think that this will not happen systematically over the next decade. Now, we'll say, I think what was also striking is, you know, in fairness, we have a pretty homogenous sample probably here. No offense to your subscribers, but they're all, you know, interested, obviously, in the topic. They probably are socialized on similar information sets around physical risk. And I think what's really interesting to see is where we have quite a few questions with a lot of divergent opinion. So it's not that great for your headline because there isn't this kind of consensus. Everyone thinks X, Y, Z. Most questions, let's take something like household response. One of the key questions we always have when we talk with banks in particular is how will climate change affect savings rates? The two schools of thought are, number one, we're going to see climate change cause an increase in savings rates because we'll see more precautionary savings because folks are preparing kind of for the worst case scenario. And then the other school of thought is what I just would call the YOLO school of thought, which is, well, you know, climate change is going to ruin all of our lives anyway. So why should we save? Let's just enjoy our life and spend our money, because why would I save to buy a house when the house is going to get flooded? Why would I save to have a better future when the future is dark and, you know, this kind of mentality? And so you have those kind of competing schools of thought. And I was hoping in the survey we'd see sort of some settle somewhere. We see that to a degree. So I think there's about a two-thirds, one-third perspective in favor of the YOLO school of thought. But that isn't quite as, that's not super clear cut, right? Where, you know, we're talking 60, 40%. 65, 35%, something in that ballpark, right? So that does mean that we have about a plus more than a third of respondents think we will see higher precautionary savings. It's not that helpful, obviously, to have that lack of consensus, but I think it highlights both the uncertainty of the topic and at least it crystallizes where the divergence is taking place. The one area in the survey where we see an incredible amount of consensus is the need to start thinking about these compound effects. And I think that's quite interesting because both it belies the fact that, you know, oh, the problem with physical risk scenarios is that they're too crazy and too wild. If I think back about the conversations we've had with financial institutions about it, sometimes it feels that way because some of the physical risk scenarios I've seen are there's a flood and a wildfire and it's like all the risks are happening at the same time. I think that's where people kind of check out a little bit. But where they feel not picked up is in those compound risks. And there's incredible consensus, plus 80% of respondents have basically said, we need to look at nature second order effects. We need to look at social second order effects. And yes, we also need to look at climate tipping point second order effects in our risk exercises. And I think that's something that really is a very strong message to regulators, to climate risk model designers and implementers, obviously, that for them to be used the right way, they need to work. And I would say one of the reasons for that is that while, you know, the trope of physical risk being slow building and, you know, multi-decadal and the tragedy of the horizons narrative, the surprise, the extent to which one event can trigger a social tipping point in behavior, whether that's insurance companies saying we've had it with this market or this region, whether it's homeowners saying we've had it with living in this region, you know, whether it's changes in, like I said, in asset pricing, where financial institutions say we've had it with these types of companies, those kind of effects we're seeing now in some cases, right? And so I think that reinforces the view that if you don't take them into account, your exercise will forever be incomplete.
Yes, I feel some of my priors need a little bit updating from this survey, particularly on this question of climate tipping points. I've gone back and forth on this because my belief was that climate tipping points are, first of all, the impacts are likely to be quite far out. And so for those who aren't familiar, climate tipping points are when certain planetary boundaries, certain thresholds are breached, affected by the rise in global temperature. So the big one that people talk about is the AMOC, right? The Atlantic Current that helps transmit heat around the world. And that slowing down or failure of that current would create massive temperature changes in parts of the world. I believe it's like Europe and the UK can actually see much more cooling and much more disruption because of a change in temperature and change in seasonality. So these are massive changes that have non-linear impacts. And there has actually been quite recent discussion on whether asset managers, asset owners, pension funds who have long-term investment horizons should be incorporating climate tipping points into their analysis. And I think it was JP Morgan who came out with a paper recently saying, yes, we are talking to asset managers and they are thinking about tipping points. And as we've seen the results of our survey, the majority of participants said that climate tipping points and nature tipping points should be considered in physical risk assessments. But what I find confusing is that a later question we have is when we ask what are the following physical risk hazards is most likely to dominate over the next decade, the majority say acute weather impacts like storms and floods, etc. And only a small number say climate tipping points. What did you make about that, about the belief by our participants that climate tipping points should be incorporated in assessments, but then the fact that only a minority said that they should be the most prominent concern over the next decade?
Well, I think it goes back to this idea of perceptions and sentiments, right? I think that's kind of been the missing piece in the conversation around physical risk. We let the hurricane run through your town. We let the flood, overcome your flood defenses, and then it retreats and it's bad. Everything's gravy, you know, like people just say, okay, that was bad. And now we've lost whatever output and all the rest of it. And then we'll just go back to our business. So I fear you have answered your own question, in fact, which is the idea that climate tipping points will be the dominant direct physical risk hazard, which was the question. So which of the following physical risk hazards is most likely to dominate over the next decade in the sense of manifesting itself? And there we had about 62% say extreme acute weather events, storms, about 25% said more chronic weather events. And then we've got 10% on nature, biodiversity, ecosystem loss, and 4% on climate tipping points, right? So that's really about what are the first order effects, the physical risk hazards. And I think in a way, I do think responses are consistent here. They are the ones that we expect to dominate. By the way, where the climate science tells us that they expect them to dominate, right? But does that mean you can just do that exercise without taking climate tipping points into account? Well, there our response are saying, no, you can't. And most likely the qualitative conversations I've had around the survey, so I have to kind of, you know, go a little bit out over my skis here beyond what people said in the survey, is that the way to think about that, and also thinking about the conversations I had with the insurance company, is more like, well, what happens if we have overwhelming evidence that over a multi-decadal time horizon, we're going to now see the AMA collapse has now, you know, started effectively, right? There's a really great study came out, I want to say February, where they looked at an early warning signal in the Gulf of Mexico or in the Caribbean, which would signal that the collapse is about 10 to 15 years out. So that could be the kind of event that you could imagine happening in 2034, where then folks say, okay, wow. And that sort of resetting of expectation, then you have to ask yourself whether you think we're in a don't look up scenario or whether people really reset their expectations. But it just doesn't seem like I said, integrating it doesn't mean making it the center stage actor, the Hamlet and the Prince of Denmark, but maybe, I don't know, Polonius, right? Maybe one of the, maybe Rosencrantz or Guildenstern. Let's have them be on stage, because we know from the climate science that they could be transformative. We know that at least the kind of the trigger of those tipping points could be measured over the next decade, hypothetically, assuming that they did materialize. And we know that they represent a kind of system change that from the vantage point of really wanting to run serious stress tests are going to be super material. We may not make them our base case, right? That's again, part of the discussion, but not having them in our risk case feels negligent.
I love the Shakespeare metaphors, keep them coming. I do wonder whether it depends on the participants' time horizons, how they answered. This comes back to the idea that if climate tipping points, you know, are triggered this decade, but their effects take some time to manifest, then it is the long-term investors like pension funds and sovereign wealth funds that will feel it. Fast money players, hedge funds, banks. I do wonder if they are thinking a little bit more short-term. And this is where I'd actually like to, in our write-up, kind of dig into the differences between what financial institutions said about this and what the more research, academic, and maybe corporate folks thought.
So it will need parsing for sure. And there isn't, at least for the scope of this podcast, you know, a one-size-fits-all answer. But I think predictably financial institutions are more pessimistic about financial markets responding, which is interesting, right? So in a way, where are we seeing the breakpoints in the survey? I think one of the areas where we are seeing the breakpoints is that, you know, we're talking about integrating climate tipping points. We're talking about, you know, household changing their behavior. But then when it comes to questions of repricing, when you, again, very high level, so, you know, this, there's some nuance, obviously, the question of how do you expect financial markets to reprice? That's an area where the financial institution respondents were a bit more pessimistic. But I didn't see these really systematic differences where you would go, wow, there's really kind of in a totally different place than our other respondent. That's probably also because while the social dimension does create more divergence, as we've established, like on a lot of these questions, there's a lot of divergence everywhere, if that makes sense, right? So that divergence isn't driven by your role, but actually by how you read the market much more than whether you happen to work in a financial institution or whether you happen to work in a research or happen to work for government. I would say the exception is in the areas of questions around repricing where just there's a little bit more pessimism at financials, probably from firsthand experience that financial markets are going to pick up on this more than, and by the way, that doesn't mean there should be, there's no repricing. Nobody thinks that, but that, you know, the extent to repricing might be a little bit less dramatic than people anticipate.
Now, one area in which I actually think there was less divergence was on the trajectory for private insurance coverage in the face of rising physical risks. And I thought this was quite interesting. We had a number of responses here. The answers that seemed most popular were related to insurers either basically withdrawing from high-risk areas very abruptly or selectively withdrawing from high-risk areas. There was no respondents who believed that essentially insurance would continue with moderate repricing in the wake of increasing climate physical risks. And there were some people who said that, oh, premiums would rise with maybe some sharp repricing, but coverage would be stable. I was quite interested to see that the majority of our response said, nope, insurers are going to get the hell out of wherever risks get too high. And perhaps that is informed by what we've seen over here in the US, for example, with selective withdrawal from high fire risk areas in California and Colorado. But I'm wondering what your thoughts were there, because this seems to me to be a real flashing light that, okay, the insurance industry really is struggling with physical risk.
Yeah. And what's even more flashing about this light is that respondents also think that households are going to look primarily to insurance to prepare for these risks. So, you know, I think that's where the survey really surfaces some pain points, right? So on the one hand, you're saying insurance companies are not going to be up for playing this game much longer. On the other hand, how do we ask the question? Let me just read it out for the audience so we know what the language is. How do you expect household financial behavior to change in response to these physical climate risks over the next decade? And the number one response, there's multiple sections possible, but the number one response was higher household expenditure on insurance. So more investment in insurance to protect yourself against these risks, basically. And so that's obviously kind of a crisis waiting to happen. And to your point, Louis, we are seeing the early seeds of that crisis, right? When you have a situation where households are increasingly looking to insurance, where insurance plays a bigger role in their life, both because it's become more expensive, of course, but also because there's a greater need for it, a sense of need for it. Just as insurance companies are withdrawing from markets, people are going to look to governments. What we are seeing is that respondents don't think governments are going to have a systematic response. Here is a pressure cooker waiting to explode. You have markets withdrawing or private sector kind of stability systems withdrawing. You have governments not catching up to the crisis at hand as being primarily reactive. And you have households increasingly looking for solutions to protect them from these risks. And if that really manifests, as our survey respondents say it will, then we're going to see pretty significant social conflict around this topic, political conflict around this topic, political instability potentially, right? Because there is, politics isn't serving the people the way they expect. By the way, also potential backlash against insurance companies is going to be likely, right? So what does that mean? Reputational issues for insurance companies and their perspective in the market. So that's why I think this kind of, again, it's one of the reasons why I wanted to run the survey like this, because I think we are really now both, you know, where is the consensus, where is the divergence, and where, when we look at the combination of questions, do we see a storyline breaks that doesn't solve somewhere in the system? And that is a really notable one. The other storyline, I would say, is on the question of how do we expect firms to respond? And one of the areas that people, we asked them, you know, how do you expect firms to respond? So to increase geographic diversification, partial reshoring to lower risk regions. So the most popular response was greater use of technology. And to be fair, that feels like a no-brainer, right? Supply chain resilience, technology to financial products. The second most prominent response was partial reshoring. So this is something where we're going to see supply chains change over the next decade. We're going to see partial reshoring to lower risk regions. So where are those regions? What are going to be the economics of doing that kind of reshoring? And by the way, say what you will about markets, but they tend to try and optimize for efficiency. So we're going to see both the physical risk impacts, but we're just going to see a lot of grit thrown into the system from companies making choices around reshoring and changing supply chains, potentially increasing inventories, restructuring other aspects, right? More than half said partial reshoring, a quarter said significant reshoring. All these are going to create costs, both the cost of reshoring, of course, but also potentially having less quote-unquote efficient supply chains. And so here too, we see a tension between, well, I thought you said financial institutions weren't going to carry a lot of the cost, but then how do you explain that you expect all this reshoring and all this corporate adjustment to take place? There is some tension here. Some of that tension is just consistent. I think the insurance case, consistent tension. It's just people believe this is going to be like a crisis, basically, and that it won't easily be resolved. Some of the tension might suggest that there may be some mental models that need updating. How can we think it's consistent to think households are going to save less, which is going to affect banks and saving rates and investment, obviously. How do we think that companies are going to do all these actions to protect themselves? And at the same time, that companies and financial institutions, to what you said earlier, are going to be the market players that are going to be the least affected by climate change when it comes to bearing the biggest load. I don't think that adds up entirely, dare I say.
Yes, there are a number of contradictions there that reality will stress test.
Yeah, exactly. And by the way, just to be clear, it's not a critique of the survey respondents. I think, you know, well, we've given them a tall task, but it kind of thinks it's I think it's that dynamic we see of that kind of isolating our preferences and our perspectives on the topic, right? And that there we don't have this holistic thing of in physics, which is too much in the physical risk discourse. My perception is that we, you know, have our kind of focus on hurricanes, and then we think about this topic, and there is, at the risk of belaboring, a kind of a point we use very often on this area, there's a lot of silos here. And so the intuition that households will bear the highest cost, I share, by the way. The idea that companies are going to introduce grit or inefficiencies or change their business models in order to respond to these physical risks, also share. All right, so what does that mean for the rubber hitting the road, right? That's just the thing, I think, where we haven't wrapped our head around it exactly for that dynamic I just described. And inconsistencies, Louis, I think is one way to put it, but also let's say incompleteness is the fairer way to phrase it, right? There's an incompleteness in the story arc of these questions that I think we'll need to spend more time thinking about.
I think there might be some false confidence in the corporate sector's ability to withstand and absorb shocks as well. Just this week, before we were recording, I read a New York Times article about how US companies are adapting to the current energy shock caused by the US-Israel-Iran war. And we are seeing corporate profits as a percentage of GDP reaching new highs in the US. And there's a number of quotes in this article about how American corporate risk management is so good. They're like ninjas. They can just adapt to anything. It's amazing. They learned so much from the global financial crisis. They use technology and they use financial innovation to basically protect their profits, expand margins, and adjust to whatever's happening. And I did find it interesting that a number of respondents, I think 61, said that they did believe greater use of technology and financial products would be used to benefit supply chain resilience. And that might come from the fact that a lot of my readers are startups and technology providers who are trying to sell these solutions to the market. But I do wonder if there's a little bit of complacency or recency bias with the perceptions that companies will be able to weather climate shocks without undue disruption, without this grit. And I'm wondering if that will be tested, especially when we start seeing these non-linear impacts, these compounding, cascading climate risks happening. And I know that's a blind spot because I keep talking to corporates and talking to finance institutions who say, yeah, people understand how acute weather events might affect their assets, their direct physical assets, but they don't really know how it's going to affect the infrastructure around those assets, how it's going to affect their people who come to the work and at their properties. There's a real understanding that there's this blind spot here. At the moment, I don't think that's captured in the urgency of corporate response right now, but maybe it's catching on.
I mean, there's one other macro, I think, theme here that's worth flagging, which is the extent to which that corporate resilience has been driven by tax cuts that corporates have received. If you take the US tax code of 2015 and just try to think about what the tax haul and the profit and dividend profile of US companies would look like in 2025, we did sort of back of the envelope analysis. Don't get me wrong, tax code is this thick. We didn't obviously go line by line. But if you just mapped sort of your average corporate tax rate the way it was in 2015, your price to earnings, which are now in the S&P 500 somewhere in the low 20s, would probably jump to the 60s. We would have 2 to 3x price to earnings. Absolutely. You know, we're talking not unprecedented because we've seen it all in financial markets, but nothing we've seen in post-World War II, I guess, and probably not something we've seen for a century, right? But it's just we don't know what that world looks like, to be honest, in any recent memory. And that has supported that resilience. The other thing that has supported that resilience is the fact, despite all these crises, government support during COVID, the extent to which that has fed into household disposable income, has meant that we are significantly richer and that households have sustained that corporate success by the fact that corporates have been able to benefit from this rising tide of household income. If we do think we see lower saving rates, then that's going to be quite helpful for that dynamic, of course, because that means continued more short-term consumption, at least in the short term or the next decade. What that means long-term for economic growth and all the rest of it, that's another story, but at least over, you know, again, the short term, we would see some continued corporate resilience. And that was the time horizon of our survey, to be fair. But if what the survey is telling us is that there are going to be all these risks and all these responses, and then we have, number one, more inefficiencies. And I hate using that word for this topic because the efficient thing to do in the face of physical risk is to reshore potentially, right? So that's not really in that sense an inefficiency, but let's say just more grit in the system. If governments at some point decide they need to reshore, they need to reset their fiscal position because they're going to need to do all this adaptation investment, need to carry, the households are going to come running to them and say, you need to backstop our insurance because the insurance companies are running out. Who's going to pay for that? It's going to be companies. So if we do, I think you're kind of, the first order effect, like you said, is companies are going to, you know, maybe not, technology isn't going to quite deliver that resilience, that ninja move that you described. But I think the second order effect is as soon as we get to a position where fiscal risk to governments is going to amplify. And by the way, that's also what respondents said was the primary dominant macro-financial spillover, rising insurance and adaptation costs, obviously. The second, higher public debt and weaker corporate balance sheets due to disaster spending. So if that higher public debt does materialize, where's that money going to come from? And if they're going to decide to go back to a tax code for 2015, then we are going to see a dramatic repricing in financial markets because that would imply multiples that are in no way backed by current prices, right? And so I do think that's kind of a bit the black swan. The two black swan events are climate tipping points and governments deciding that they're going to use corporate balance sheets to basically kind of reset their fiscal position.
Yes, you can kind of see the chain of consequences, right? Like if fiscal risks are being taken on household balance sheets that can't really sustain them, then there's the government backstop that has to kick in. Governments start to take more of that strain on their balance sheets. And so they have to find ways to equalize that. And that's by, yeah, raising taxes elsewhere. So it makes sense that corporates would have to absorb more of that. But I think that's interesting as well. Like that creates political tensions, right? Because governments are facing pressure to also keep businesses and keep wealth within their borders, which also makes me wonder about whether this reshoring narrative could also lead to some really interesting political dynamics and actually trade conflict between countries and even within states, right? You have this in the US, different states kind of compete on tax rates, trying to draw people in. And you can imagine a scenario where a state is getting particularly hit by climate risks. I'm thinking here about Louisiana, I'm thinking here about Florida, but they do whatever they can to kind of keep businesses, keep people in their state and try and subsidize basically their climate risk profile. But I can see that mechanism occurring, but I can see a lot of political conflict as that gets shaken out.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, on that topic of political dynamics, I think one of the things that we've seen, And again, this is similar to the transition risk dynamic. You know, we always have this debate, well, you know, physical risk, sure, we've got our 1 in 1,000 events and they're going to be bad, but they are perceived as being slow building, constrained by the physics. And climate tipping points are a perfect example for that. Really, the state of play on the science doesn't expect climate tipping points to be the dominant physical hazard over the next decade. So in some ways, why are we even asking that question? The climate science gives us the answer, right? We're very, very good at change the climate very, very fast, but very, very fast is still eons in the world of financial markets that operate on year, month, day, time horizon. That being said, political dislocation, the war in Iran is a perfect example for that, can move so fast and can operate at light speed. And it's not just a question of, yeah, sure, do we really expect in all our transition risk models for governments from one day to the next to dump coal and pivot to renewables because of climate? You know, that's the discourse I always had when building these transition risk models. This is going to be well signaled. There's going to be consultation process. Right. That's exactly how politics is operating at the moment, right? So, you know, that's the kind of non-linear shifts. And by the way, household response is even faster than that, right? Like once households have made up their mind, they can move super fast. Sentiments, obviously political viewpoints can be very volatile, especially in the modern age with technology amplifying some of these dynamics and those exposures. So this is something where over the next 10 years, the world could look really different. And right now, when you look at the job advertisements that are coming out on this topic from financial institutions, they're looking for climate scientists and climate risk modelers and all that. We are at the risk of sounding loosey-goosey, going to need some social scientists to help us out here. We are going to need some economic geographers to help us out here, because this is going to be a massive economic geography story to that. There's going to be a lot of social science and behavioral dynamics to it. And of course, the politics that in the short run will determine the winners and losers of this dynamic, because this will be ultimately, primarily, in all likelihood, a political choice. Who will have to carry that burden? And that political choice will be constrained, to your point, by the competing between states, the economic competition and lobbying and social dynamics and all the rest of it. And that will constrain that choice, but the choice will be political. And what you believe that choice will look like will probably be the most important question you need to answer in order to wrap your head around how you as a business are going to be positioned vis-a-vis physical risk over the next decade.
So social scientists, you have your marching orders. Come into the climate physical risk world. We need your help. I did find that interesting on the human geography, economic geography side, because the last question I wanted to focus on was this migration question. And this is actually one that surprised me. So we asked, how do you expect migration patterns to change in response to climate-related physical risks over the next decade? And I've heard about, in the States, folks moving away from Arizona and the South, where it's getting too hot, or where storms are affecting property values, and moving back to places that are seen as less climate vulnerable. But our survey showed that actually a plurality of people think there's going to be either a gradual migration or significant migration waves. Actually, quite a lot of people said significant migration waves are likely following major events. And that sort of surprised me that it would be that abrupt. And I was just wondering what you thought about the distribution of responses in relation to this migration question.
So on the question of migration, I think we're really driven by our biases. And there's one variable here that's really important to flag, which is, do we think it'll be cross-country or not? So we know there's climate migration already. We know it's really material. We can blame parts of the Arab Spring on the food price crisis and yields in 2011 and so on, climatic conditions as well that we would expect to see replicated in potential physical risk events that impact food stability. Another thing folks highlighted as a major driver, by the way, in our surveys, food stability. But will that lead to cross-country migration? And I think a lot of people answering our survey are probably in situations where they don't necessarily personally think they will migrate, and so believe that the kind of barriers to migration might be a little lower because they live in quite comfortable areas, you know, not putting anybody on the spot answering the survey, but most will likely be in Western economies, in Europe or the United States, based on our list. And that many of them will live probably in major cities and don't necessarily see them migrating for climate reasons, but could very well imagine that as a hypothetical just because of how they understand the dramatics to be. But what that might mean for uprooting your households and uprooting your family and your life and your economic situation, all the rest of it, those are big deals. But most of that is within countries still, right? Which means it could be really important for investors, again, to have that kind of regional, sub-regional, state-level look as they're thinking about different economic dynamics in different markets. I think the idea that that will be material over the next decade, I share. The cross-country spillover will probably be determined on the economic stability of the country. And that's something I think where that's sort of the wild card, right? So will we see migration waves where folks will say, this whole situation here doesn't fly? Or are we going to see, at least over the next decade, actually a first wave, which will be much more within countries, and that kind of cross-country spillover will still be contained to a degree? And that obviously depends as well whether you're talking about US, where we'd expect most migration to probably be from, right, wherever, from Arizona to Minnesota or I don't know where.
Michigan. People are raving about Michigan these days.
Oh, is it? All right. Well, I should go. And whether we're talking about Cote d'Ivoire or, you know, sub-Saharan African countries, they're going to just have a different kind of systemic exposure to these risks. But I do think that these micro choices of migration behavior, I think we're reaching a tipping point here. Personally, that's my assessment. That's what our survey respondents are telling us, by the way. So, right, almost 90% of respondents said either gradual or significant migration, which means not almost 90% think there will be some meaningful migration, right? It's another way to read that answer. The key disagreement within that 90% is whether it will be gradual or significant. And I think the key answer to whether it will be gradual or significant won't be by whether climate will be that bad or this bad, but will be about literally everything we just talked about in the last hour, which is the political dynamics, the economic dynamics, the spillover effects, the tipping point effects from social dynamics. And that will determine, I think, ultimately how that migration pattern plays out.
Yes. Again, I think political and, I suppose, international cooperation factors could determine how extensive cross-country migration would be. You know, like if there are efforts by the international community to stabilize a country that is suddenly economically ruined by a series of compound physical risks, that might prevent outward migration. Similarly, if we have the ratcheting up of extreme anti-immigrant policies in parts of the global north, that might be a deterrent. But again, I think the political dynamics will determine whether cross-country migration really takes off. Okay, we could go into every question and 100 different ways, go in the cross tabs, and I'd like to do that in a write-up down the line. But to finish off, Jacob, I wanted to ask if there was any other aspects of the survey that surprised you. And then also, I'd like to do this again with you. I hope you feel the same. What should we do differently next time? What other insights would you like to get next time around?
So what surprised me? I think what did surprise me is actually the degree of divergence of views. I thought that we didn't know what people think, but I thought we're going to have a lot of herding perspectives. And we did see, right? Like if I just take the migration example, like we just have almost 90% say there will be migration, so call that herding. But actually they're split almost exactly down the middle as to gradual or significant, which makes all the difference in terms of what that might mean for you as a financial institution, obviously, gradual or significant. And so that kind of divergence of views, I think, is very striking. And I think really helps us understand that we need to do more to understand, to turn that sentiment, which this survey was. It was just a sentiment check. It wasn't, you know, on each question, do desk research for 3 hours and tell us what you think. It was, what was your sentiment on the topic? To turn that sentiment into maybe more hard intelligence. And so I think that's really now the next step. And I think that's where that survey can be quite useful, because if you are a climate risk model provider, it kind of gives you a sense for what people are looking for in terms of the extra features. If you are trying to figure out how to calibrate household behavior, it gives you some guidance as to which kind of parameterization choices you could do. And it gives you a sense for where that, like we said, that narrative arc might be incomplete or inconsistent, even in some cases, but at the very least, perhaps incomplete. Ultimately, this screaming message out of every response in that survey is that we will see some significant costs coming down the line. And the core question is, one, who will carry it? And two, will we have enough institutional capacity to absorb it to prevent the kind of social conflict and political conflict and militarization, all these other factors that we talked about? Those are the two questions now on the table, right? And I think that survey screams at all of us to take those questions seriously and to start basically being able to kind of, if not quantify, at least scope and parameterize them in the way we think about our response to physical risk. If we do the survey again, I think we will hopefully be at a point where we can actually start asking people to put some numbers on their views, whether that's probabilities. I think probably you and I were both a little too intimidated to ask this as a first round, because we all know, and I think listeners know, that the kind of questions we're asking, we all haven't thought about enough, you know? So then coming at people with saying, probabilities is probably then creating maybe some false precision in our responses as well. But hopefully we can get to that stage where we can actually ask people to put probabilities on it and actually map those social dynamics with the physical risk dynamics. So we can kind of say almost like, if you believe this hazard map, then what does that tell you about the social response versus other hazard maps? Because that's obviously the confounding variable in all these responses is people have different priors. The hard climate science, which are going to determine whether the thing migration will be gradual or significant. And so that confounding aspect is, I think, fine for now, but would be wonderful to try and marry in these kind of exercises.
I've been interested in regional distribution of views as well. There are certain views of how markets react in the US versus Europe, certain sentiments about the resilience of government balance sheets in Europe and the US and South America as well and Asia as well. So I'd be interested in that, but we might need a larger sample size to achieve that sort of granularity. And well, I'm hoping that we can do this again and have an even greater response pool and even more granular insights to share next year.
And let's see how those views change, right? Because we, as we knew, you know, we've got the alarm bells are ringing about the Super El Nino coming up. You covered this as
yes.
well. I wonder when that comes down the barrel, if it comes down the barrel, you still obviously don't know, whether that might change perceptions again as well.
You made me think about that annual global risks report we see from, is it from the WEF, World Economic Forum? And it's always recency bias, like every time, like the year after COVID struck, the number one risk was zoonotic diseases.
Yeah.
And then like after Russia invaded Ukraine, the top risk was geopolitical conflict. And so you can imagine if we have a very bad El Nino, then again, climate risk will come to the top.
My favorite phrase in the English language, and the American listeners will appreciate this, is Monday morning quarterbacking. And there is a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking on this topic. So hopefully that survey can do the opposite and actually try and do a bit more, let's say, Friday night quarterbacking, if that's the thing.
All right. I'm going to try and sign off again, Jacob. Thank you so much for your time chatting with me today about the survey. Thank you for conducting the survey with Climate Proof. And I look forward to collaborating with you in the future. And I hope our listeners really dig into the results and get in touch with myself and with you, Jacob, to discuss. We'd really like to continue this research theme. But for now, thank you so much, Jacob, and have a great rest of your week.
Thanks. Take care.
Climate Proofers is a Climate Proof Media production. It is produced and presented by me, Louis Woodall. Subscribe to the Climate Proof newsletter by going to climateproof.news/subscribe. And to learn more about the publication, feel free to reach out directly using our LinkedIn page. Goodbye for now.